modeling was definitely a career that Christina was really passionate about. For her to be in Playboy, I mean, that's something she'd always wanted to do.
Thousands of women would submit photos every month to be a cyber girl. You have to be gorgeous. And Pef could have seen something really special in Christina. But Playboy models get a lot of unwanted attention from men. It can be a real problem, especially if you find yourself around the wrong person.
There had been prior activity related to Christina.
She did allude to the fact that she thought she may have been drugged.
She heard a man somewhat forcefully telling Christina, "Don't call the police."
This person had told him perhaps the most chilling detail in this whole case.
I was in complete shock.
Who becomes a victim like this twice in a couple days?
Hey, y'all, welcome to Docu Talk Through, the podcast where I talk you through the best documentaries in the streamosphere. This is episode 19, and this is going to be part two of the Playboy murders. And this episode two is titled Moth to a Flame. So let's get into it. Okay, we start out in Ardmore, PA, and this is August 22nd, 2018. And we start off with this shot of this police station, Ardmore, PA police station. And we're hearing from a detective, Gavin Gashinsky. So he was in the detective unit of the Lower Marion Township Police Station. So there was this call that comes in about a well-being check. It doesn't say who called, but someone was calling requesting a welfare check on Christina Kraft at her place of residence. So that's what this detective Gavin Gashinsky is talking about. And I guess she lived in this high-end condo complex in Ardmore. And so we see the front of this complex. We hear from this other guy, Vinny Vella. These names, Vinny Vella. And I guess this Ardmore is right outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And I guess this neighborhood is like wealthy, kind of upper class. So I guess he's saying that to say they weren't used to getting calls of this sort in that area. And this guy, Vinny Vella, is a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And so we hear this other guy, another former detective of Lower Marion Township. His name is Michael Weiss. And he's just giving like some background on this neighborhood. Like, it's just like a close-knit community where you can walk to the bars, walk to the shops and things like that. Gavin Gashinsky is saying, like, these are the kind of people that live here. They call the cops for everything, for every little thing. You know, people who think, you know, you call the cops when a cat is stuck in the tree. So he's saying, like, that's the kind of people that live here. And so he's saying normally he wouldn't go on a check the well-being because it just wasn't his job to do, but he decided to go on this call right away. Okay, so he's saying that he had been notified that there was prior activity related to this lady, so he decided to go. There was a man named Alex who made the call, and I guess he's the boyfriend of Christina, so he's the person that called. He called her cell phone several times, and he couldn't get into the apartment, so he called the cops because he didn't want to be breaking into this apartment.
She was in her mid-30s. She was a Playboy model.
The victim was found strangled in her condo. Police made that disturbing discovery on Sibley Avenue in Ardmore. They were called there to make a welfare check.
You don't hear things like this happening here.
Never really heard of anything more than parking tickets and jaywalking, you know? Hearing a murder or a strangling like that is just traumatizing.
So they show this reenactment of him trying to get into the door, and we see the door lock. Now there's also a chain on the door. So we see the cops busting in and breaking down the door. So we see two cops, one busting in, one still in the hall. And then behind the second cop, it must be Alex, the boyfriend. And so we are seeing them. You enter right into the kitchen of this apartment. Right on the table, you see a purse sort of hanging on the corner. And it's all dark. All the lights are off. And they make their way to her room. And the first thing they see is blood spatter. So we see this reenacted scene. There's a wine bottle on the floor. There's a lamp turned over on the floor with blood splashed on the lampshade. It definitely looks like some kind of struggle happened or something like that. And they see a body
under the bed, and there's a comforter laying on top of her. So they pull the comforter back, and badly beaten body of a female. And he's saying there's no question that it was a homicide. So she had a broken nose. There were fractures in both eyes. She was strangled to death. And this was Christina Carlin Kraft that was dead in this bed. And we see a picture. We see the first picture of Christina Carlin Kraft. Okay, so now we're going to get some background on Christina Kraft. So Christina Carlin Kraft was the Playboy Cyber Girl of the Week on May 4th. 2009. And we hear this from Holly Madison. Remember, Holly Madison is going to be the host for all of these episodes and the executive producer. And so we see these pictures of Christina. We hear these different people talking about her. We hear the journalist Vinnie Villa talking about her. She grew up in South Jersey, along the shore. So I guess from an early age, she was interested in modeling. And we just see these different model shots, model poses of her. She was also interested in the entertainment industry. In 2000, she graduated from high school in Linwood, New Jersey. And we hear Megan Sachs, who's a criminologist, and she has a podcast, Women in Crime. I'm going to check that out. Women in Crime podcast.
In 2000, Christina graduated from high school in Linwood, New Jersey. And for a couple years after that, she worked as a waitress in the South Jersey area and in the Borgata in Atlantic City. In 2003, Christina met Alex, her longtime boyfriend and future fiance, at the Jersey Shore on Labor Day weekend. And the two were incredibly close. He was very supportive of her modeling career. The two were a couple for 15 years until the time of her death.
They were together for 15 years. Wow. That's a long time. 15 years and then never got married? Wait, 15 years? I'm trying to see. So 2000, she graduated. So she's 18. Holy. So this is like, so she's with this dude from 3 years out of high school until she died. They never got married. Okay. So anyway, Christina's father said that she was the light in his life and she was the oldest of his kids. And they had a very close relationship. We are talking to this lady now. Her name is Eva Walls, and she's a model, and she was Christina's friend. And she's holding up a photo of three girls, three ladies in bikinis. And I'm thinking she's one of them, and Christina's one of them, and then there's another one. So she's holding up this photo, and then she's saying this is the photo shoot that she actually met Christina. So they were doing this photo shoot together, and that's where she met. Okay, so now we see a close-up shot of this photo. It was like a three-day event, three-day shoot, and it was for the magazines Maxim and Stuff. We see all these different, we see Cuba Gooding Jr. at this event, and he's posing with one of these ladies. Look familiar. Look like she may be an actress or singer or something like that. Maybe, I don't know. But he's Cuba Gooding Jr.'s. So, you know, this must be a celebrity weekend thing. Like, what, you know, one of those Hollywood things. And so she's saying this was a model search. This event was a model search. And we just see all these different models in bikinis. So they were so these women were flown in from all around the country. And so Eva and Christina were chosen as the Maxim and Stuff magazine model search winners. Okay, so Eva and Christina won this search. So she's saying they got along great. Christina was very charismatic. She was a lot of fun. And we see all these different cover, these different magazine covers. And they put Christina's photo on several of the Maxim and Stuff covers. And we just see these different covers fly, like flashing on the screen. And so, of course, exposure like that is going to boost your career. So that's what happened. It boosts their modeling career. And so I guess she always wanted to be in Playboy. So this kind of propelled her, Christina, to get that gig. So Holly, we're back to Holly Madison, the host. She's saying Christina, in addition to Maxim and Stuff, she did some other modeling for other men's magazines. That's fine and all, but Playboy is the pinnacle. You can be in all those, but still the goal was to get into Playboy.
On the Playboy.com website, you could join what was called the Cyber Club. It was a subscription membership, and each week they would showcase a nude photo shoot of a different woman, and she would be the Cyber Girl of the Week. A Playboy Cyber Girl had an online pictorial. It was very similar to the Playmate pictorial. It was a very glamorous, softly lit nude pictorial. editorial, and there would be a little blurb about the girl.
I didn't know what this cyber girl of the week was. So evidently, you're not, it doesn't necessarily mean you were in Playboy. You weren't in a magazine, but on this website, on this Playboy website, she became the pick for the week of this cyber girl online type thing. Okay, so that sort of put a little more information into it, because I thought she was in Playboy, in the Playboy magazine, but I guess so far not. I haven't, so far as of now, she hasn't been in the magazine. So anyway, but Holly Madison is saying that it was still a big deal to be a cyber girl because it was a stepping stone to even bigger things. So we just see all these different shots of the cyber girl online profile, and I guess her cyber girl shoot went live in 2009. She got invited to the mansion. She did all the same stuff that the girls who get into the magazine do. So when you're selected as cyber girl, you go to the mansion and you do a test shoot for the magazine. So she got to go to the parties and stuff, and she had all the same access as the other girls. And we see her posing with Hugh Hefner, and Holly's saying, like, to meet Hugh Hefner. All these girls don't get to meet Hugh Hefner, I guess. But if you do meet him, that means you caught his eye. So I guess she never became a playmate. And Holly's saying, like, the playmate selection process is incredibly competitive. Thousands of women, you know, they send in their photos every month to be considered to be a Playboy playmate. And from all those pictures, only one can be chosen, one a month. And so ultimately, I guess Hugh Hefner is the final decision maker on who becomes Playmate of the Month. And Holly Madison is saying it's not necessarily that she wasn't pretty enough, but it could be maybe they had too many brunettes scheduled that year. It could be something trivial. It could be some fickle, or they were just looking for something a little bit different story. It's not all about looks. Maybe her story wasn't the right fit for the, which I never even thought about. I didn't even know I thought it was just about looks, face, tits, and ass. That's all I thought it was about. Like, story, who gives a shit about it? It's a Playboy playmate. So I guess that's part of it, their story. So she was 26, and unfortunately in the Playboy world, that was considered a little old. Are you kidding me? 26? For women to put themselves under this kind of scrutiny to where someone would say 26 is too old. And so Holly is saying not being picked could take a toll on someone's mental well-being. Like, you know, here you are, your whole life is based around beauty and wanted to be in this thing. And then when you don't get picked, then, you know, comes the self-sabotage of, I'm not pretty enough. And whether you know all the factors or not of the decision-making process. So that's pretty much what Holly Madison is saying. Like, you know, how supposedly attractive you are perceived to be. If you don't get picked based on that, you know, it's going to hurt your self-esteem. She picked up other modeling gigs, you know, that didn't have as much scrutiny. So she ended up moving to New York. And Holly is saying, like, when someone, once you pose for Playboy and you pose nude for Playboy, not a lot of people want to touch you. You got this P on your chest. You got the Playboy bunny on your chest instead of a scarlet letter. You got a Playboy bunny on your chest. Nobody want to really touch you. And it's funny, I keep hearing that throughout these episodes, but I guess a lot of these women don't know that going in. They don't know, hey man, if you don't get, if this Playboy thing don't work for you and you pose nude, that's gonna hurt you. That's gonna hurt you big time. It's definitely gonna be hard to go out and get a regular gig. You can't go get it. Can't go be a teacher. We're back to Eva. She's saying, when you put yourself out
there like that, those pictures are out there forever. You have to think long term about your future and, you know, your career down the road. And not that it's negative at all for some people, but in some light, it can look negative.
Christina's modeling career didn't take off after her Playboy appearance, and she was kind of left adrift. Playboy as a brand really has no, you know, support for women once they're not working for them anymore. I think they just look at it as, well, you know, we can't babysit all these women for the rest of their lives.
So we're back to August 22nd, 2018. Gosiewski is talking about, upon realizing that Miss Kraft had been murdered, they met with Alex, her fiance, in the hallway, and he told her that Christina's dead. And he reacted the way, you know, you think someone would react. And we hear Michael Vice saying, like, when something like this happened, it's sort of, you call in the cavalry. It's all hands on deck. He need anybody and everybody that can come in. So they called everybody. So they did as much on the scene as they could. Then they started canvassing the neighborhood. They started knocking on doors to see if anybody heard anything. They start walking the neighborhood. They got the dogs out. And we hear this guy, Jim Mailwert. He's another reporter for KYW News Radio. And he's saying, like, you know, in this neighborhood, this doesn't happen. A lot of these documentaries I see, you hear that. It's like, you know, I guess that's what makes it documentary worthy, or, you know, when something like this happened in areas that it's not supposed to happen. So not knowing what really happened, people in the neighborhood, definitely the neighbors, start to wonder, hey, should we be worried? Is there a, you know, killer on the loose? Should we be worried? So people start assuming the worst. People start panicking. People start paying more close attention. So these journalists, of course, you know, they roll out. They want to dig up and find out as much stuff about Christina as they can, especially because the way she was murdered viciously in her apartment with the door locked, which is crazy. And so far, they haven't talked about how did someone get in if the door was locked, and if that reenactment was correct, there was a chain on the door from the inside. So maybe we're going to just find out that later. So this Vela guy, he's just saying, like, you know, they wanted to find out as much information about Christina as they can. They're talking about her online presence. She had a clear online presence. Yeah, she was cyber girl. She was Playboy Cyber Girl of the Week. And so front and center of Christina's web traffic was an article from the New York Post about an incident that she had in 2016 in Manhattan. So we see this July 5th, 2016 article of the Metro. It says Playboy model faces assault charges after restaurant scuffle. So there was a dispute over paying her tab, and she got into a physical fight with a bar manager. She was charged with a misdemeanor assault, but ultimately prosecutors in New York, they dropped the charges against her. So in 2017, and we're hearing all this from Vinny Vela. I thought they said Vince, but anyway, the journalist. So in 2017, she had moved. That's when she moved to Ardmore in 2017. And this was suggested by her boyfriend, Alex. And he felt that Ardmore would be safer than where she was living. So that was the whole reason they moved out here. And it was also closer to his parents. So we hear Eva saying, you know, he said he wanted to protect her. He just felt like she would be safer there. But you think New York is unsafe. So no matter where she lived, you just think people who don't live there just think, hey, New York, unsafe. Chicago, unsafe. Big areas, unsafe. Big metro areas, unsafe. So Ardmore must be like this little small town. So that's why he wanted them to move there. And that's where she was murdered. So he traveled back and forth from Ardmore to New York for work. Let me see, how far is? Oh, so it's like a 2-hour drive. Okay, so he worked during the week and he stayed in New York during the week, and he was back in Ardmore on the weekends. They never mentioned what he did for work. So far, they haven't mentioned what he did for work. But we hear this. We hear the detective Michael Vice saying he must have had a good job. So Megan Sachs saying she think life was a little bit difficult for Christina because she was alone a lot. That's so weird that he spent most of his time in New York, but he wanted her to move to Ardmore where he will only see her on the weekends. That's kind of weird. But all the excitement and all the stuff that she was into was in New York. And now here she is in this little small town. So it must have been quite a change to move to this little Philadelphia suburb from New York. So just like in the first episode, and just probably like it's going to be the common theme with all these episodes, you know, these Playboy models, or actually any kind of model, definitely models that has nude pictures out there, they're going to get some unwanted attention. You know, they're going to get that creepy attention, them stalkers, those fetishers. They're going to get that kind of attention. So, and who knows who was watching her and she didn't even know it. So we see this news article, this news broadcast.
Police on the main line are searching for a killer after a model is found dead in her condo.
Christina's death drew a lot of media attention, both from local news outlets in the Philadelphia region and beyond. There were tabloid reporters from Europe who wrote about this. There were tabloid reporters from New York City who came down to write about it.
I think Christina Kraft's status as a Playboy model, the fact that she's a young, beautiful woman, certainly drove press interest in the story.
A model was found strangled.
When the victim has been a part of Playboy in any way, that's the one thing that gets pulled into the headline.
So, of course, in these type things, the spouse, the boyfriend, the significant other, the ex, are always going to be first up at bat for suspects. So no different with Alex. And we hear Goshinsky saying that he asked Alex, would he be willing to go back to the station and, you know, do all the stuff, do the questioning and everything. And he was forthcoming. He was like, yeah, let's go do it. So they're back at the station. And now we hear from Vice. Vice was getting a statement from Alex, and they were starting to get his story. And they were asking him all the ins and outs, going into detail about every aspect of their lives. So Alex says on August 21st, he made it back to New York City for his job. So he stayed there. He called Christina early morning on the 22nd around 2:30 a.m. to say goodnight. And she didn't answer the phone. So he kept calling and never got any answer. Around 5 o'clock, he started to get concerned. He started calling it just after 2, and then now it's 5 a.m. I mean, she could be asleep, though. That's late. I mean, I don't know what her normal schedule is, but that seems like somebody will be asleep. Anyway, so he started to get concerned around 5 a.m. So he checked the security camera they had at the Philadelphia apartment. He noticed some unusual activity, and this is when he decided to return to Philadelphia. So he left New York and returned to Philly because whatever he saw in those cameras, he didn't like. So he returned to Philly, and we go back to Goshinsky. He's saying, yeah, we're going to check all this stuff out. Alibis and everything is going to be checked out. They said Alex, you know, he was cooperating. He was sincere. That sort of eased their mind as far as him being a suspect. He was cooperative. They don't think, you know, with the distance from New York to, you know, where she was in Philly, they don't think he could have did that in that amount of time based on the timeline he gave them. And so Alex sort of gets pushed down on that suspect list. They don't think he had anything to do with it. So they now started trying to find out more about Christina's life and tracking her movements and see what she was doing that day, what she was up to that day. And so we heard a journalist, Vincent Vella. They said that they discovered early on that she had filed a police report. Christina filed a police report a few days earlier complaining that she had been robbed in her apartment. The murder happened on August 22nd, 2018. And on August 18th is when she filed that report. So she called Lower Merion Police Department and told them that she had been robbed of some personal items that were pretty valuable. Some, you know, designer handbags, some jewelry, and a credit card. So she must have been drunk because she said she remember going to Center City, Philly, and drinking at a hotel in Center City. And so we see this redneck, man. She's sitting at a bar having some drinks. And we hear Vice, the detective, saying when they spoke to Christina about the burglary, she said that she woke up in the day. So, okay, so she could have been dosed. She could have been dosed at the bar. So she's saying she don't remember anything. She just didn't feel right. Something, she knew something wasn't right. And she alluded to the fact that she thought she may have been drugged. I heard this in a podcast where, you know, when you think about people getting drugged, you think about date rape drug, you know, the date rape drug, GHB, right? You think about people drugging women to sexual assault. But evidently there are crooks out there that it doesn't matter if you're male or female. They use GHB or some other type of drug, and they just mass dose people at the bar, and they wait to see who's going to be most out of it, and then they rob them. That's sort of what she's alluding to, like someone drugged her and then robbed her. And we hear Madison, Holly Madison, talking about, yeah, there's a lot of people who do that. She's heard stories about people who, you know, were having drinks, and then they get their drink spike, and they're not being able to remember anything. Man, that is terrifying, man. Like, not once. When, you know, all the years we went out drinking and going to the bars and stuff, that was never on my mind. I never thought about anything like that. It's a crazy world, man. You know, women or men, when people offer to buy you a drink, just buy your own drink, man. Don't go out under the guise of, oh, I'm going to have people buy my drinks. Buy your own damn drinks. Buy your own drinks. Stay with your drinks. If you want to set your drink down and dance, don't do that. Drink your shit. You know, drink your shit and then go dance. Man, you just got to be, you got to be paranoid a little bit. I tell my daughters, be paranoid. Be paranoid, man. Like, don't leave your guard down. Or better yet, do like I do. Just drink at home, man.
So that's what Holly Madison's saying. Like, yeah, she's heard stories like this, and this is really scary. It's really terrifying. That's what's so weird to me that, again, she didn't know this. She was in a new city. She didn't know anybody here. She knew people in New York, but for some reason, the Alex dude thought she'd be safer. It must be something they're not saying why he figured she'd be safer outside of just, yeah, New York is a big city. She didn't know anybody here, so she must just been at the bar by herself drinking. We hear Michael Weiss saying that when she gave her statement, you know, she was really, really affected by this. She felt violated. She made references of not feeling safe. And they told her, you know, they're going to do everything they can to figure out what's going on. Again, that was 2 days before. So evidently, the condo had surveillance video and the detectives were able to get that video. So they look at the video and it looks like somebody gave Christina a ride back to her building from Philly. And evidently it was it was like a Uber or a Lyft. And we hear this Jim Melwert, he's the reporter from KYW News Radio. He's saying the identity corresponds with the rideshare driver. And so that was around 3-something in the morning when they arrived back at her apartment, and she was passed out in the back seat of the car. So he took her keys, went into her condo. What? So we see this reenactment of the rideshare driver leaving her in the back seat out. He get her keys. How do he know what apartment she lived in? How do he know exactly which building she lived in or which unit? So it was just around 4 a.m. and we see this reenactment of this dude just in their house. And it seems like he spent about an hour, or actually over an hour and a half inside her house. And this is based off the surveillance footage. And he was presumably stealing shit. So we see the reenactment of him grabbing shit, running out. Then he came down holding a box full of Christina's stuff. And then we see him bringing her out of the car and taking her inside. Okay, so he helps her all the way to the elevator. And then they don't say if they just say he helped her into the elevator. They don't say if he helped her all the way to her unit. So they got screenshots of the guy on the video. They put out pictures everywhere. And the man in the video seen going to her apartment, he was a black dude. And he was just wearing sort of a, you know, like, just nondescript clothes. We see this news report.
Police are looking for a man accused of stealing items from the victim's apartment just days before her death.
So a few days later, after Christina woke up and figured out she was robbed and she made the police report, she went back to the police station a few days later to talk to the police again. And I guess sort of to let them know how serious this situation is or how serious she's felt about the situation. And she was just trying to figure out what's going to happen next. You know, did they find anything out? Is she safe? Did they find her stuff? When they started tracking her car, the car that was stole, they started seeing that it was, oh, it's been used. They said some of her credit cards. So she had more than one credit card stolen. They started to see it used at a nearby convenience store. So this dude was just using the shit in the hood. Well, allegedly, he was using it right in the same area. So they get images of the person using the card at the convenience stores. And we see these CCTV footage, and we see a guy. We can't really see his head. We see a guy. He's going over. He come in. He used the card, and then he walks out. So they are able to match those videos and the person in those videos, the ones at the condo, and they match. So it's the same person. So they definitely know. Well, how hard would it be? They like, again, this is a guy that's working for a rideshare. So it shouldn't be hard to figure out who brought her home. That should have been open and shut, right? Why do they need to put up pictures? If this was a rideshare and she used the rideshare app, like, let's just continue. So they figure out who the guy is. So the cops actually recognized this person as a guy named Andre Melton because they had arrested him before. So this guy is known to the cops. So you mean to tell me you can have like an arrest record for shit and you can do, see that, man, I've only used Uber once. I've only used a red ride, and that was just because I got stuck in Denver because of a, you know, flight cancellation. So I just stayed up there instead of coming home and caught a flight the next morning, and I used the Uber. That's a whole, I think I talked about this on one of the episodes that whole fiasco. But anyway, we see a picture of this guy. He's a black dude, but he looks like he may be mixed or something. And he got one of those freeway beards. I call them the freeway beards. What he got. So Andre Melton, according to Gushinsky, is a dangerous guy. And they were actually concerned about him returning to the apartment. So they wanted to get him off the streets quick. So they were trying to get a search warrant for where he lived. They wanted to get a search warrant for where he lived in Philadelphia. So on the morning of August 22nd, the day that Christina's body was found, they get a warrant for Melton's arrest. They go out to his address and they find all the stuff that this fuckface stole. They found the bags. They found all the stuff he took, but they can't find him. So this guy has a violent history. So the detective were definitely worried about what he's going to do. You know, he's looking good as a murder suspect, because what they're alluding to is like, what are the odds that she'll be a victim of robbery? Actually, you know what? There's a few things going on. First, she thinks she was drugged. That could be the same guy, or there could be a different guy, because if it was the same guy that did drugged her, that took her home, and he's a ride share, that means that's a different level. That means he's a predator. It's one thing if she's at the bar, she gets drunk, she calls a ride share. This guy is already a crook, right? So he looks for these crimes of opportunity. She's clearly passed out drunk in the back seat of his ride share. He's like, you know what? Let me go in here and look around, see what she got before I help her out this car. That's one thing. But if he's a ride share driver, he drugs her knowing that she's going to need a ride home, gives her a ride home, and robs her, and comes back and murder her. That's different. So they thinking that's more likely than she gets drugged at the bar by one person, and then crime of opportunity, this rideshare driver sees she's passed out, he goes and rob her, and then a totally separate guy happens up on her apartment and murders her, like a victim of at least two different crimes, you know, not really knowing if she was drugged or not, or just drunk. They don't really know if she was drugged or not. That could have been a third crime. But they're saying that Occam's razor, the most likely thing, got to be what happened. Like, this guy robbed her and killed her, but they can't find him. And right now, for sure, they got evidence of the robbery. So they're looking for him for that robbery. Because if this guy is on the street and he's this predator, like, you know, if we're looking at it as like he's drugging women, robbing them, and murdering them, he's not just going to stop. He's back out there doing it again. So they got to get this guy off the street. Okay, so we hear the journalist saying again, he said, Andre Melton led cops on like this little cat and mouse, like, try to find me. And we hear this news reporter, Alicia Neves, she's saying they're dealing with, you know, really two different things. They're dealing with this burglar involving this model, and then the second, her death. So, yeah, again, so it could be one person, or, I mean, like, most likely, or she could have been a victim more than once by different people. So these detectives are working around the clock to try to find this Melton guy and try to get this thing resolved. So they started to get more video footage from the condo of the night of her murder. Here's the timeline. They're showing videos spliced in with reenactment. So on the night of Christina's murder, there's clear footage of her exiting the building, heading towards Philadelphia. So hours later, there's additional footage of her returning to her building, being escorted by an unidentified man. So she's walking back with some dude back to her building. This is the night of her murder. Now, this is not the night she was robbed with a rideshare driver. The Melton guy was bringing her up. She's clearly walking with somebody now. So they come in shortly after 3 in the morning, and they walk in together. They get in the elevator and they go up. Now, anytime her security door opens, the security system alerts and records the time. And we sort of see like a reenactment of this. We see a lady opening the door and we see a timestamp. So at like 3:08, doors opens and they both go inside. And then there's no other door movements until about 10 minutes after 5 in the morning. So about a 2-hour window. So that dude who entered, he never came out. They never see him leaving out. Investigators at this point think that he must have left another way. Remember, on the reenactment, they showed the door locked from the inside also with a chain on it. So not just key locked or deadbolted, where you can do outside with a key. It had a chain on the door. So this dude who went up with her, he left another way. He didn't go out that door. She's on the second floor. She has a balcony and she has a slider to the balcony. So around 5 o'clock a.m., the slider opens. So there's a time stamp on the slider also, the slider door. So the real balcony isn't that high off the ground. So you could jump off and roll or whatever, and you can get away that way. So being that the front door never chimed again, and that back door was the last thing, that slider door was the last thing to chime, they're assuming that's the way he went out. So now they have detectives on the ground searching in that area looking for evidence. And now they find a footprint. Not just a footprint, but like a foot stomp in the ground, like, you know, if somebody jumped off a second floor balcony. So they know Melton, you know, they know he's a crook. They know he's dangerous. But now they're saying it looked like this guy would be a prime candidate to commit murder because he knew what her condo was like on the inside. But OK, so Vice is saying he wouldn't say there was anything that would lead us to say that he's a prime candidate to commit murder. So I guess they're kind of say it's a big leap from a guy who, crime of opportunity, he's going to go burglarize her house and then help her up. And she's so out of it, she won't even remember. That's a big leap from going from that to killing her. I don't think so, because what if he went back for some reason and thinking she wasn't there, like he thought he left something. You know what I mean? Now he's going back, but she's there, some kind of scuffle, and he ends up murdering her. The way they talked about him before, like, now you're saying you don't think he would commit murder? You just say he was dangerous. What does dangerous mean? When I think of a burglar, just simply somebody's a burglar, I wouldn't say that's a dangerous person. I just say that's a crook. That dude be robbing people. Actually, burglarizing, robbing is a whole different, somebody who robs is dangerous. But I'm saying burglar. But they said he was dangerous. But now he's saying he don't think he would commit murder. So from August 22nd through August 25th, the detectives were just retracing every step of Christina's that they had evidence of, that they could prove, you know, they could validate. So they go back down to Center City and they start pulling surveillance videos to try to put more pieces of the puzzle together. So they wanted to see where she was. And from those images, they were able to show her movements from her destination when she first came to Philly all throughout the Center City. As she walked down different streets, around different clubs, different bars, different nightclubs, we hear Vice again talking about, like, it was just a matter of collecting all the footage, all the evidence that they can validate, put it together into a timeline. Okay, so now we see the actual surveillance video of the guy she was walking down. So we hear Vice saying that he remembered at Broad and 13th, they were walking together. You know, he got his hand around her. It's another black dude. He's wearing like a do-rag, and it is so weird. Like, okay, so this is the actual video surveillance footage, right? We know who's murdered. They're walking down the street and they have her blurred out. Why is she blurred out? But anyway, so at Broad and 13th, they see them get into a ride share. And that ride share took them to Christina's house. And the guy on that video, it was not Andre Melton. So now they got another suspect. So now they put out an alert about this guy. They started distributing information and they wanted the press to put their info out there. So now they put out surveillance videos to the public of both men. They put out one of Andre Melton and they put out another one of this other guy. I wonder again, why haven't they talked to the rideshare person that took them? So now there's two suspects out there, and investigators, you know, they didn't know if these were related, if these guys knew each other or what, but they put both of them out there. August 23rd, Vice gets a phone call, and guess who's on the phone? It was Andre Melton. Vice said he was surprised that, you know, this guy we're looking for, now he's calling me. So Melton calls like, hey, man, let's get this shit right. Yeah, I'm a thief. I stole her shit, but I ain't kill nobody. I ain't going there for no murder. So Megan Sachs, she's saying that Vice wasn't convinced by Melton calling in and saying, I robbed her, you know, I stole her stuff, but I didn't murder her. She's saying that Detective Vice wasn't convinced at all. He didn't believe him. You know, he believed even if he wasn't the one that murdered her, he had some involvement because the timeline, it was just too close of a timeline. So he believed that Melton either knew the guy or had something to do with it. So he was involved in some sort of way. So there was speculation that these two dudes were, you know, they were connected. One dude they named already, but one dude still unnamed. But I guess as they started investigating both of the guys, they couldn't make a connection. So they don't think they were in cahoots. So now we're at August 25th, 2018, 3 days after Christina's murder. And we're back at the police precinct. And the investigators, they were still looking for tips, still for looking for anyone who would come forward who knew something about this, who knew either of these guys. So one guy came forward and he was a rideshare driver. And he said he recognized the man and the woman in the photo. Somebody he had actually given a ride to from Philly to Ardmore on the night of the murder. So this may be the rideshare guy. And again, why they didn't just go to the rideshare company? Why they didn't just get, I mean, somebody had to pay for the rideshare and it's done through an app. I don't understand why that guy had to come forward before. I don't know, it's something just weird. But anyway, so they started talking to the guy and he was the guy who picked them up that night. And he said, you know, it was mutual. It wasn't, like she was being forced. He said Christina had approached him and flagged him down. Oh, okay. So Christina flagged him down instead of using the app. So it was Christina who held the car, just like you held a cab. So she didn't use the app. And she told the guy that she needed a ride because there were some people on the street harassing her. So the guy agreed to give her a ride home. Is that against the rules? Can you just get flagged down as a Uber or Lyft driver? Can someone just flag you down without using the app? So anyway, he took Christina and the dude home. Well, yeah, to Christina's apartment. And he said during the ride, they appeared to be very friendly, very, very affectionate with each other. Now, remember, Christina and Alex, they still dating. They're supposed to be her fiance. Seemed like they were making out or at least getting close. And when they arrived in Ardmore, Christina didn't have any money to pay the guy. And she promised she was going to pay, but now she's not paying the guy. Now she offered him an American Express card. I guess she had earlier promised the dude she was going to pay in cash. So, but he had no way of taking no damn credit card because she's not using the app. You know, she didn't use the app. All he had to do was make her reserve a ride with the app and then pick it up. Like that, this all seems so convoluted. It seemed like there was a perfect storm of things that lined up, a perfect storm of things that shouldn't have happened that lined up. When you look at it, it's like there's so many red flags of stuff leading to something happening. You know what I mean? You promised to do cash. I mean, I'm definitely not blaming the victim here. I'm just saying, like, this wasn't like just some night out. And then, I mean, it just seemed like a bunch of stuff. She was getting harassed. She needed a ride. She's with maybe she knew him, but as of now, it seemed like a stranger in this ride share. She promised to, it's like she's making enemies along the way. You know what I mean? She promised this dude cash. Now that's somebody who got something against her. But anyway, so the dude who she was with, he offered the dude $100 cash if he would stay parked outside this building for 10 to 15 minutes while they went inside. They exchanged phone numbers. And we're hearing all this from Vela, the journalist. So they exchanged phone numbers and the person promised to call him when he was ready. 20 minutes later, he never heard anything from the passenger, so he just left. Dude bailed out. Remember, because he was from Philly. So he bailed out and left, and that was it. Around 4 a.m., and this is from Megan Sachs, around 4 a.m., Christina was somehow in a very charged situation, was able to contact her cousin. She didn't leave a message, or she didn't speak, or anything like that. Her cousin could hear the background And what she heard was a man telling Christina not to call the police. So now we're on August 26th. Police got a call from a man who said that he knew who this dude was. Now we got somebody who actually knows who the dude is. And again, we're seeing this guy on the surveillance. And again, they have Christina blurred out, but we see this guy. And there was somebody that he was roommates with in a psychiatric facility in Philadelphia. So this dude that Christina got into the car with was in a psychiatric facility in Philadelphia. And let me get this. Let me say this. Just because somebody was in a psychiatric facility don't mean that they are batshit crazy. People go into psychiatric facilities voluntarily or involuntarily. And all the people that I've known who went into a psychiatric facility, it was due to issues with themselves. It wasn't due to issues with them trying to harm anybody else. So let me just put that out there. So I'm not just saying like, oh, this dude's crazy. He went into a psychiatric facility. Now, if this was 20, 30 years ago, if I would have heard this without any knowledge, yeah, I probably would have thought that. And people probably think that. Life brings you lessons and you learn stuff. And I know for a fact that if you go into a psychiatric facility, it doesn't necessarily mean you're some crazy, batshit crazy person. So I'm not saying that. So this guy with the tips, he knows this guy from the psychiatric facility. So they check out the tip and they were able to trace it back to an incident in Love Park in Center City, Philadelphia. So we see Love Park, John F. Kennedy Plaza. And so I guess evidently this guy followed a woman into a family court building and started harassing her. He began causing a scene in the building, kicking windows, screaming, yelling. And we see we're outside a Penn Presbyterian Medical Center, this hospital. So this must be where they took him. So they take this guy to custody. Okay, so he was put on a 72-hour psychiatric hold. So that's an involuntary medical hold, a medical psychiatric hold. So this witness or this guy with this info, he told them something that was pretty scary. And it was the fact that this dude had recently strangled a woman and had bragged about it. Okay, so now we have some evidence, well, some verbal hearsay that this guy may be a predator. And it said that he was bragging about it and said there was no feeling quite like feeling somebody's life escape them as you choke them. So when this guy was admitted to this hospital, he was admitted as a John Doe. So they don't even have any information on the guy's name. I didn't even know that was possible, but evidently it is. All right, so while all this was going, they get another call. And it was a family member of this guy and found out his name was Jonathan Harris. And he had recently been released from prison. And we see a picture of Jonathan Harris. Doesn't look like a scary monster. Most monsters don't look like monsters. So he served a sentence for robbery and had just been released on July 15th. So approximately a month before. So 5 weeks before Christina's murder. Now, but by the time they got all this info, this guy was gone. He bailed out. He's in the wind. So now we're at August 28th. Now we're at 6 days after Christina's murder. And so they were able to get an arrest warrant for Jonathan Harris for homicide and related charges in the death of Christina Krell. So now again, we got another guy who's considered to be dangerous and unpredictable. Remember they said that about the other guy, Andre Melton. So now they're saying this guy is dangerous and unpredictable. And they thought for sure, you know, based on him bragging about strangling women, that this guy was going to hurt somebody else. Okay, so they end up talking to one of Jonathan Harris's sister. And his sister told him that he bought a bus ticket. And the bus ticket was to Pittsburgh. So now we are hearing from this other guy. He's Matthew Roth, and he's a Philadelphia state trooper. The Philly cops called the Pittsburgh Fugitive Task Force and said, hey, we got a guy we need y'all to apprehend.
Police say that 30-year-old Jonathan Harris had just been released from prison in July.
Harris definitely had significant criminal history, nothing like a homicide in his past, but forcible felonies as far as robbery, drug dealing, burglary. We print out pictures, make copies, so everyone's actually carrying a photograph of the last arrest photo.
So now we're at August 29th, and Philadelphia cops told the Pittsburgh Fugitive Task Force exactly when that bus was going to be arriving. So they had the team in place right there, you know, cutting off all the avenues of escape, ready to get this dude. And they was just like waiting for that bus. And so they had a scout car out and saw the bus coming into the area. So they knew the bus was on its way. And so the bus came, the bus made it. The bus started offloading passengers. This fugitive task force, they're waiting, got their binoculars. They're sitting in the cars. They got all the exits, all the escape routes blocked. And they're just waiting for this guy to get off the bus. And we have this Roth guy. He's right by the door. And he was about Jonathan Harris was about the third person off the bus. They let him walk off the bus and look, making sure it's him, looking at height, weight, looking at build. They got the photos. They they're not making it obvious, but they're trying to make sure they know it's him. And once he was certain it was the guy, he approached him. He ordered Jonathan Harris up against the wall. And Jonathan Harris, who was kind of shocked, he looked back. He was like, oh, damn, this is a cop. And he started looking around. You know, Jonathan Harris looking around like, I'm about to rabbit. It was too late. They were waiting for him. And so the cop, the Roth guy, goes in. He asks him if he was Jonathan Harris. He tried to lie, say he wasn't Jonathan Harris. But they were pretty sure it was him. And they put them bracelets on him. They called Philly, told him that they got him. They sent two detectives from Philly to Pittsburgh, took him to the station, to the interrogation room. And so we hear Vinny Vela saying, they start talking to him, start asking him about, hey, what happened on that night you were with that lady, Christina? So here's his account.
Initially, he told them that he had seen Christina around, that he recognized her from being in Philadelphia.
Christina was by herself in Philadelphia in the suburbs. She missed her friends and the exciting lifestyle of New York City. So I think she was going out to recapture some of that.
I think the reason why she was going out and grabbing a drink by herself is she's probably lonely. She was by herself. When you're by yourself, you're going to get approached.
It started out very friendly by all accounts, but just hours later, the evening took a terrible turn.
He mentioned that he was pretty high on the day of the murder. He had smoked some marijuana, he had used cocaine, he had been drinking, and he also mentioned to using K2, which is a street name for what is essentially synthetic marijuana.
He says that they met in Center City and that they were going back to her apartment, and he had an ounce of cocaine that he was going to sell her. She says that she's not going to pay him for the cocaine, and he gets angry. He's scared because he needs this money, and so he says there was a physical altercation. At one point, she hit him with a wine bottle, and things got out of hand.
Oh, so that's why they were showing that wine bottle at the reenactment of the apartment setting. They were closed up on that wine bottle, and I thought it was to show that she'd been drinking, but I guess that's because she used that wine bottle to hit him. So there should have been DNA on the wine bottle then, right? Maybe there was no blood on it, so they didn't think to check that wine bottle. But anyway, so she was out by herself. This dude was already hopped up on weed, cocaine, and whatever. So now he's gonna sell her some cocaine. Now I wonder if that was before or after they got in the car. Cause remember, she didn't even want to pay. Well, she didn't want to use cash to pay the rideshare driver that she had promised money. So he was a stranger. She didn't even know him. He met her that night. He said he's seen her around, but he never said they met before. But anyway, so this guy said all that happened. They fought, they struggled, but he didn't have shit to do with her murder, with her death. He said when he left the apartment, she was fine. Of course, you know, there were some holes in his story. There were some inconsistencies. So the coroner didn't find any drugs in her system. They let him stew in the room for a little bit. Then they come back and they ask him, hey, are you telling us the whole truth? You know, he realized, you know, just by some of the stuff the investigator started telling him and started letting him know that, bro, we know that's not the way it happened. We know there's some stuff you're leaving out. And so once they start doing that, and once he started to see that they had more information than he realized, he started to talk. He confessed to killing her. He said he panicked. So he ended up admitting that after he killed her, he covered her body with a blanket, an area rug that was in the apartment. He admitted to changing into her clothing because his was covered in blood. And he admitted to jumping off the balcony because he knew there was cameras in front of the building. So he was charged with first and third degree murder. So Andre Melton was arrested in December of 2018. He was arrested for that, for stealing her shit. He also had some drugs on him. Okay, so he was stopped on another occasion for drugs, and then but he had that open warrant for the burglary. So he was sentenced for robbing Christina to state prison. They don't say how much time he got. So now we're in May of 2019, and this is the murder case. It's going to, I guess he didn't take a plea because it's going to trial. He pleaded not guilty.
The jury found Harris guilty of first degree murder, and he was sentenced to life in prison.
A Philadelphia man accused of murdering a one-time Playboy model has been found guilty on all charges.
At sentencing, Alex Cicatelli, her fiance, got to address Jonathan Harris. And, you know, we called him a coward, that he, you know, strangled and choked a woman much smaller than him. And he also said how hurtful and painful this had been for the family. Alex said, it wasn't bad enough that you killed my fiance, but then you also had to come out with this line and just slander her and drag her through the mud with this line about the cocaine. Doesn't have any cocaine in her system. They never found any cocaine or traces of cocaine in her apartment. And her fiance says, as long as he's known her, she's never used cocaine.
There was so much evidence against Harris that it was hard. It was hard for him and his attorney to put any sort of doubt into the, you know, any sort of reasonable doubt into the jury's mind, because they had the footage. They show him going in. They show him never coming out. He confessed. It just so much shit lined up. They got the rideshare driver showing that he was with her that night. He was the last person to be seen with her. You know, just so much stuff. So I guess when they charge him with first and third degree, it's so he can get one, at least one. The first degree murder come with a mandatory life. So I guess he was pleading not guilty to first degree murder. So he was trying to get the third degree murder, which comes with a sentence of 20 to 40 years. But the jury found him guilty of their first degree murder, and he got life in prison.
And that's it for this episode. Send all your questions and comments to docutalkthrough@gmail.com. That's docutalkthrough@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.